This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The Milwaukee Bucks will open their home basketball season November 2nd against the Toronto Raptors. As they have since 1988, they'll call the BMO Harris Bradley Center home. But in February, a new commissioner will take over in the NBA, and Adam Silver is on the record as saying he doesn't believe that Bradley Center is up to NBA standards. Vague proposals for how to accomplish a new downtown arena have been in the air for some time, and Bucks owner Herb Cole has pledged to contribute some significant amount to get it done. But as Doug Russell writes in Milwaukee Magazine, the Bucks' future here is far from certain. He's with us now to dig a little deeper into the issue. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Let's start with a ticking clock idea. What is the NBA's concern with the Bradley Center? Why does the league care if there are more restaurants or luxury boxes or other high-priced amenities here?
Because all of the other owners are in partnership with, you know, Herb Cole. And there is revenue sharing in the NBA. And when there are teams that aren't generating as much revenue specifically with their buildings, that's when the league starts to get involved. And, you know, they look at the situation and they see all of the other revenue generating amenities that other arenas around the NBA have. And they look at the ones that have the deficiencies. And there are a couple of buildings that have glaring deficiencies right now. Two of them are in Northern California, in Oakland and in Sacramento. And those two buildings are scheduled for demolition, and there's a plan to replace those buildings. There's no plan yet here in Milwaukee, and that's why Adam Silver, who's going to be the incoming commissioner of the NBA in February when David Stern steps down after 30 years at the helm, he was in town about 3-4 weeks ago. And he said, you know, Milwaukee's part of our culture. Milwaukee is part of the NBA. The Bradley Center is a nice building that has served its purpose, but it needs to be replaced.
Well, and the average fan looks at it and says, hey, the Bucks ended up with a better record than a lot of teams last year and a lot of teams with nicer and more modern arenas. But at the end of the day, what the fans see as a victory isn't necessarily what the league sees as a victory.
Well, that's true. And you also have to keep in mind that you know, wins and losses on the court are but a small part of the entire pie as far as the NBA is concerned. And fans are concerned about wins and losses, and they should be. But owners are businessmen, and businessmen are concerned about bottom lines. And, you know, there's this adage among some in the NBA that, well, the NBA as a league doesn't care about small market teams. Well, three out of the four teams in the Western Conference playoffs last year were in markets that were smaller than Milwaukee, in Memphis, in San Antonio, which, at least according to the Nielsen ratings, is a smaller market than Milwaukee, and then, of course, Oklahoma City. And Oklahoma City has been a marvelous success story as a small market that has embraced the NBA, and a really small market that's embraced the NBA. And Memphis has had their growing pains as well, but as long as good basketball decisions are being made, that's what is going to spell whether or not you're going to get wins or losses on the court, not off the court.
Well, and so let's talk about the connection between wins and losses and economics. There has not been a lot of grassroots buzz about the need for a new arena here and the need to keep the team in Milwaukee. Does that change if the Bucks put together a winning season? Does the needle start to move if the Bucks, you know, they're clearly not going to win the conference, but if they do a lot better this year?
Oh, it helps. And I think that that's one of the reasons that Herb Cole has – it's hard not to say Senator Cole, but yeah, I guess you can still say Senator Cole. It's one of the reasons that Senator Cole has never embraced the idea of tanking. He doesn't even like the word tanking. What I mean by tanking is intentionally not putting forth your best effort in an effort to then get a better draft choice, and then you can get – perhaps a player like a LeBron James or a Kevin Durant or some of these superstars that are currently playing in the National Basketball Association. He's always wanted to put out the best team that they could possibly do. So having a winning season, and they were in the playoffs last year. They got swept by Miami, and there was a lot of dissension at the end of last season as well. But having a winning season and building that momentum, it certainly helps, at least as far as building some goodwill with your fans and trying to build the grassroots.
Although you make the point that the Bucks' record really has not been very good overall since Herb Cole took over as owner of this team since he bought the team. Is this in some way chickens coming home to roost for Herb Cole not going all the way and putting a better team on the court?
I think Herb Cole has tried to put a better team on the court. Sometimes And I spoke with some former members of the Bucks front office. Larry Harris was quoted in the story. There was another individual that was not – he was quoted in the story, but just on a condition of anonymity. And the overwhelming sense is Herb Cole cares about the fans. He desperately wants to win. He just doesn't know how to win.
And nobody would say a bad word about Herb Cole.
No. I mean, even those that he fired, Larry Harris being one, has nothing but glowing things to say about this man who hauled him into the office one day and said, you can't work for me anymore. So I think that's pretty remarkable, even though, you know, someone who had a very high profile position and his father had a very high profile position with the Bucks got fired by Herb Cole. Kind of looks at it like him as this beloved grandfatherly figure almost.
You're right about the business leadership that's getting behind this, Tim Sheehy, for starters. What about political leadership? Why is this arena idea such a difficult thing for politicians to want to stick their necks out on?
Two words, George P. Tech. It goes back to the Miller Park debate of 15, 16, 17 years ago. And George P. Tack, if some of your listeners may not be familiar with him, he was the state senator from Racine who at the last minute, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning in Madison, changed his vote on the Miller Park, ultimately wound up being a 5-county sales tax, and he wound up being recalled from office from that. It's a political hot potato right now, and nobody wants to stick their necks out right now because – taxes are too high, most people believe. And what are we getting for those taxes? And why should a billionaire owner and multimillionaire players be subsidized by we, the taxpayers? And that's the ultimate, tug of war that goes on in communities all over the country in regards to public financing for these venues.
You write a lot about the Oklahoma City example, mm-hmm. and a lot of people are pointing to it, the idea that they were able to pass a limited tax to support a new arena in a pretty conservative place. The tax also supported a variety of other civic projects. Does anyone have a sense for whether that might work in Milwaukee?
It probably wouldn't because Oklahoma City literally had nothing when they began their MAPS project. Metropolitan Area Projects is short for MAPS in Oklahoma City. And they did that in three different referenda. And their motto was, look, we've got nothing here. We've got to build something here. And if you don't invest in your community, we're not going to really have much of a community to, want to live in, work in, grow our families in. So what they did, I think the Sacramento model is probably closer to what Milwaukee did. But what they did in Oklahoma City was they said, this is what this is going to be earmarked for. We're going to raise all the money before we put shovel in dirt. And that's what they did. And after the first time that they did that, the taxpayers kind of got the idea that, okay, they're being pretty diligent with what our investment is, and we will then approve the next two referenda, and it's worked marvelously for
them. And so talk about the Sacramento model. What did Sacramento do that Milwaukee might stand to learn from?
They have a public-private partnership, and I think that's the only way that this is going to get done. But they didn't raise any taxes in a community that is already taxed to the hilt, as are all communities in California. Their financial issues are very well documented. But what they did was they took the parking revenues from the city-owned lots and the city-owned spots on the street. Every time you plug the meter, that goes to paying the public portion of the new Sacramento arena that is going to be built in the next couple of years. Kind of an ingenious approach that their mayor, Kevin Johnson, went toward.
What are the chances that the needle moves on this conversation at all before the 2014 election?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mitch. I'm not sure. An inside source says that Governor Walker doesn't want to touch it until he is either voted out of office or reelected, and then it would be the next governor. And you could probably say the same thing about Mayor Barrett as well, whether or not he's going to seek out another term as mayor of Milwaukee. I think sports fans should be a little bit disappointed in that. But again, it's so political. And if you look back at Act 10 from Governor Walker's first term in office, he did that right away. And he spent the last 3 years, kind of save the recall election, the last 3 years trying to maybe move more toward the center as opposed to the right. And I think that that's kind of the model that you're looking at with this as well.
So what do the experts say about the potential economic impact of a team leaving town? There's some disagreement about what the real hit is.
Yeah, it all depends on what economist you want to believe. And you know what they say about statistics. Statistics don't lie, but liars use statistics. So I could throw a million numbers at you, and there would be someone else who would counter that. From everyone that I have spoken to, there is more of a prestige factor with having an NBA team or a professional, major league professional sports team than there is an actual economic benefit from that, save for a community like Green Bay where there's not a whole lot to do other than being kind of engulfed in the Packerdom, right, if you will. But in a city like Milwaukee, the effect is smaller because you've got other sporting avenues like the Brewers or Marquette or even the Wave or the Admirals or, you know, UWM basketball or something like that. But that money that would otherwise go to the Bucks might be spent at the Art Museum or the Symphony or, you know, doing something else with that disposable income as opposed to going to the Bucks games. So there's a prestige factor. I don't know if there's a huge economic factor that goes into that. And as a sports fan, it pains me to admit that, but you know, that's the truth of the matter.
It's hard to quantify a blow to the ego.
Very much so. Very much so.
Doug Russell, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mitch.
Doug Russell's article on the future of the Bucks and the Bradley Center is in the October issue of Milwaukee Magazine. In his other life, Russell covers sports across town at WTMJ Radio. There are rumblings of negotiations in Washington that could end the federal government shutdown. But contentious words from some politicians and some regular people continue about the future of the Affordable Care Act. And Lake Effect essayist Alex Runner says that is something we can't afford.
Nearly every American, myself included, knows someone who doesn't have health insurance. We know educated, hardworking, family-supporting citizens of this great nation who simply don't have what amounts to a basic necessity in the 21st century. Those of us who are fortunate enough to work for businesses, nonprofits, or governmental entities that provide health care benefits, we win. Those of us who currently find ourselves unemployed, underemployed, or self-employed, we lose. Certain people pay very little for life-saving medicine and procedures. Others might lose their life savings. That's not hyperbole. That's not exaggeration. It's the simple truth, and it happens all the time. One person pays $100, while another person pays $100,000 for the very same treatment. In no way, shape, or form is this capitalism. In fact, it's corruption. This is not the free market. It's racketeering. And there's plenty of blame to go around. Doctors who exchanged honor and house calls for fatter wallets and slimmer souls. Health insurers who never tire of buying low and selling high when it comes to human health. Ambulance-chasing lawyers who love to brag about winning far more than any injury is worth. The rest of us who, to quote an accountant from 300 years ago, sit back in our embarrassment of riches, screaming bloody murder if we have to shell out a few dollars more for our copay, never even noticing the fellow citizens who line up outside the ER for basic health needs, whining about the price of gas, patting ourselves on the back for our false frugality, self-soothing our self-centeredness, and blaming every problem on the government boogeyman. We're not acting like adults. We're acting like children. We think that compromise is a weakness, but any kid who can't compromise gets put in a timeout. So the current predicament makes perfect sense. We've put the once great nation of the United States in a timeout. Know what Abraham Lincoln, the founder of the Republican Party, was often called? The Great Compromiser. But this generation confuses that kind of strength with weakness. People who compromise look to the interests of others instead of solely satisfying themselves. Compromise is humility. Compromise is leadership. Compromise is American. Especially when it comes to health care. The stakes couldn't be higher, which is why the right to life is spelled out in our founding document. The debate is literally about life and death for millions of our fellow citizens. Military veterans who fight tooth and nail for freedom but come home unable to afford surgery. Is this the greatest country on earth? One where we don't care whether our fellow man is on the brink of financial ruin because he can't afford a routine procedure? One where a single mother has to work three jobs to pay for her child's medicine? The problem isn't the Affordable Care Act. It's not Obamacare. The problem is us. We, the people, are the problem. The reason we don't have the American government right now is because we don't deserve the American government right now. Maybe we will someday soon, but not right now. not when we behave like this. Today, we don't deserve to be called Americans.
Lake Effect essayist Alex Runner lives and writes in Sherman Park. A version of this essay also ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Keep listening. When we return, we'll talk about some of the many accents and dialects that shape how we talk in Wisconsin and learn how Wisconsin talk sounds different than what we'd hear elsewhere in the country. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.